So following on from last week, how do we get out of Romans 7 and into Romans 8? We said last week the Christian life is a struggle. We asked the question, how can we win it? How do we win the battle so that we can experience joy and peace and usefulness? And by way of answer, we looked at the source of victory and the pattern of victory. Remember, we were looking at Romans 8, verses 12 and 13. And then we give five principles in relation to establishing that pattern for victory. You know, with the recognize the presence of sin. Secondly, have a heart fixed on God, or our eyes steadfast on God. Thirdly, meditate on the word. Fourthly, commune with God. Fifthly, be obedient. Now, I want to come back to that theme of gaining the victory tonight and focus on the first principle in more detail, recognizing the presence of sin. It's important to recognize the presence of sin because, you know, when we succumb to sin, it can leave us feeling very discouraged. So if you turn to Psalm 38 for a second, this backs up what I'm saying about, you know, feeling discouraged, feeling guilty when we succumb to sin. The psalmist is saying, verse 1, O Lord, do not rebuke me in your wrath, nor chase me in your hot displeasure. Verses 2, 3 to 6, your arrows pierce me deeply, your hand presses me down. There is no soundness in my flesh, nor any health in my bones, for my iniquities. He's talking about his sin. For my iniquities have gone over my head like a heavy burden. They are too heavy for me. My wounds are foul and festering because of my foolishness. I'm troubled. I go mourning all day long. You see what the psalmist is saying. He's saying to us, sin causes problems. Sin brings big problems. And no Christian can give testimony, honest testimony to the fact that when they became a Christian, sin was erased and they've been sinlessly perfect, you know, ever since. Not so. The tendency to sin is still in our lives. Even though we've been saved, we still sin. And I think what's worse, you know, when we, to be honest, we derive pleasure from our sin. Isn't that right? We struggle with sinful habits, but not just sinful isolated acts, but habits. And habits of which we're honest, we say we derive pleasure from. And sometimes we fall into shameful, scandalous sins. Our thoughts and our words are not always what they ought to be. Our time is often wasted on frivolous and worldly pursuits. Our minds and our affections are often set on things that will pass away. Our hearts often grow cold to things holy and evangelistic. As I said, the question we're trying to address is, how do we deal with these? How do we gain the victory? And to answer that, I want to use a story from the Old Testament. And this will help give us a vivid picture of how we are to deal with remaining sin in our lives so that we can have a clear conscience. So we turn now to 1 Samuel 15. First Samuel 15, and what I've really done with this is a number of years ago, Young People's Talks on a Sunday evening, I think over a period of about 4 weeks, we looked at how we tackle sin. So really just sort of compressed those Young People's Talks. But First Samuel 15, this great Old Testament story, will teach us the seriousness of sin and the righteousness of God's holy wrath against it. It's a graphic illustration of, or analogy of, how believers have to deal with sin. So verse 1. Samuel said to Saul, the Lord sent me to anoint you king over Israel. Now therefore heed the voice of the words of the Lord. Now friends, you'll remember that Saul was chosen to be king because he was head and shoulders above everybody else. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. He was what the people wanted, and so the Lord agreed to let them have the man that they wanted. He was to be anointed king. But there was a caveat. There was a catch to this. If he was going to step into this kingly role, there was something that he had to do, and that was to listen to the words of the Lord. He would bring himself into a position where he was going to be ruling, you know, the people of God. And because he was going to be ruling the people of God for God, he needed to listen to God, who was their true sovereign. And it gets very specific. Here's what the Lord has to say. And here's, you know, what Samuel has to listen to and obey. So verses 2 and 3. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he come up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have, and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infants and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Now, friends, that's what you and I today called genocide. Go and wipe out that whole race, a whole tribe in this case, not really a race, but a whole tribe of people named after the man Amalek. God's command is very clear. Saul was to deal ruthlessly with these Amalekites. He was to kill not only men, but all women and all children and all babies, and kill all their livestock, kill all their animals. The whole tribe was to be utterly, mercilessly taken out of existence. No hostages were to be taken, and the implication is no spoil had to be taken either. Now, the question immediately arises. Why would a God of infinite love, a God of infinite mercy, a God of grace, mete out such severe judgment against this pagan tribe? Well, let me see if I can answer that question for you. The Amalekites were an ancient tribe. They were nomadic. That is, obviously, you know, they traveled around. They occupied southern Canaan. They were descendants of Esau, and therefore they were out of the line of promise, as Genesis 36, verse 12 indicates. They were the perennial enemies of the Jews once the Jews came into the land of Canaan. In fact, the Jews approached the land of Canaan initially, and they were, remember, they were afraid to go into the land because they were frightened of the ferocity of the Amalekites. The Amalekites had engaged in war against the Israelites, and they did that in a very cowardly way. What they did was they attacked the rear of the Israelites, you know, this massive humanity that's moving out of Egypt into the promised land. What they did was attacked the stragglers, those folks that were at the rear. The stragglers, the old people, the little children, pregnant women, the sick, anybody weak, anybody weary, anybody faint, they attacked them. They ambushed Israel, massacring all the stragglers and working their way up until finally the battle was engaged in. And God delivered Israel that day. You read about it in Exodus 17. You remember the story where Moses is having his arms held up in intercession, in prayer. And the Amalekites fled into hiding. And in the conclusion of the battle in Exodus 17, verse 14, God swore to Moses, this is what God said, "I will utterly, totally, completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." Now God says, "I will wipe out that entire people." And God was so committed to this that he made a vow. He made this vow, part of the Mosaic Law. In Deuteronomy 25, just listen to the last three verses of Deuteronomy 25. "Remember what Amalek did to you on the way, when you were coming out from Egypt, how he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear, when you were tired and weary." And here's the real key. "And he," that is Amalek, "and he did not fear God." Well, because of that, "Therefore, it shall be when the Lord your God has given you rest from your enemies all around in the land which the Lord your God has given you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." And then God adds this, "You shall not forget." So this must come to pass. These treacherous, vicious, intimidating, deadly people, the Amalekites, God's anger burned against them because of their wickedness. Now, according to Numbers chapter 24, verse 20, God even called on the corrupt prophet Balaam to prophesy their doom. Judges chapter 6, verses 3 and 5 says that these people came up against the Jews, and what they loved to do most of all was come up against them and destroy their crops. And of course that would mean destroying their livelihood and their food supply. These Amalekites, they hated God. They detested God, they detested God's people. And they delighted in violence against them. They were vicious sinners. Now friends, because of all this, and because God had made that vow in the Mosaic Law, God was going to destroy the Amalekites. So we come to 1 Samuel chapter 15. And it's time for that judgment to take place. And God says, now that Israel has a king, it's time to act. Go and strike Amalek. So Saul and his armies were to be the instrument through which God was going to keep his vow and would carry out his holy execution against this sinister tribe. But Saul's disobedience was only, or Saul's obedience was only partial. So let's pick up in verses 7 and 9. "And Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is the east of Egypt. He also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them, but everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed." You see, motivated by covetousness, motivated by the love of money, they kept all the best animals, they kept all the best possessions, collected the spoils of victory. Now, they didn't even do a thorough job of executing the Amalekites. A lot of them escaped. And worst of all, they spared Agag. They spared this king. My friends, why would Saul be so blatantly disobedient? Well, it wasn't just materialism. In this case, it was also pride. Here was a marauding, vicious, terrorizing monarch of this tribe who was known by everybody in the region as the greatest warrior and victor, before whom others crumbled. Now Saul was going to show how great his power was and how mighty he was, how his great force had got this trophy, Agag. And he was going to say, you know, look what I have. Look who I have defeated. You see, it was pride as well as materialism. It was just an evil heart on Saul's part to flatly and blatantly disobey God. But the sin was so serious that God immediately deposed Saul and all of his descendants forever from sitting on the throne. Look at verse 22 through to the first part of verse 24. So Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king." Then Saul said to Samuel, "I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words." My friends, Saul had claimed that he had kept some of the animals, some of the best animals, in order to offer sacrifices. That was his claim. And God, speaking to him through Samuel, says, "Do you think I'm interested in burnt offerings? What I want is obedience." And then the judgment came against Saul. "Because you have disobeyed, I'm going to remove you from the throne." Saul was dethroned. That was how serious the issue was. Go down to verses 32 to 33. "Then Samuel said, 'Bring Agag, king of the Amalekites, here to me.' So Agag came to him cautiously. And Agag said, 'Surely the bitterness of death is past.' But Samuel said, 'As your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women.' And Samuel hacked Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal." My friends, it's rather sickening when you think of that scene. It was God who commanded it to be done. And Samuel did it before the Lord, and Samuel was no soldier. Samuel was a prophet. He was a priest. But here was God sending out divine judgment and holy wrath against sin. Unlike Saul and the rest of the Israelites, Samuel carried out the Lord's command. Now, this is a tremendous picture of God's attitude toward sin. Sadly, however, the battle that was supposed to exterminate the Amalekites, supposed to wipe them out, ended before the goal was accomplished. Apparently, the Israelite soldiers were so busy collecting the spoils and making sure that they were sorting out the good animals from the bad animals that they never did the job that they were supposed to do. And Scripture records that a few years later, an invigorated Amalekite tribe raided the southern territory and took all the women and children captive. But as I said, this is a tremendous insight into God's attitude towards sinners and his holiness and wrath against sin. And I want you to see it as an analogy, as an excellent illustration, analogically, of sin that remains in the believer's life. When you and I were saved, there was at that moment crushing defeat of sin. But we still have remaining sins. There are still some Amalekites running loose in everybody's life. We all have our Agags. And the problem in our Christian lives is not that sin has not been defeated with a crushing defeat. It has. But there is still some remaining sin. There are still some loose, iniquitous Amalekites in all of us. And though there was a great and glorious and triumphant defeat at the time of our salvation, friends, there is the necessity that our remaining sins need to be hacked to pieces, or else they will revive and they will plunder our hearts and they will sap our spiritual strength. We cannot be merciful with the Agags of our life. We cannot be merciful with the remaining sin in our life, or they will turn and create an insurrection and a rebellion that will attempt to destroy us. Remember last week we used a little illustration, I think it was under the third point. We can't clean up some area of our lives, but hold on to that little bit of sin that we really delight in. Be like, you know, cleaning up a garden, but keeping one area of it full of weeds. You know, the weeds aren't going to stay there. Before you know it, they're going to cover the whole garden. And it's the same with sin. You know, we can't say, well, I'm going to get rid of all this sin, but I'll hold on to this wee one. That little sin will soon cause an insurrection and a rebellion that will bring you down spiritually. In fact, it may well be that, like the Amalekites, the remaining sin in us often becomes fiercer, more formidable than ever before. Certainly the children of Israel had felt that the Amalekites were a defeated foe. Their king had been hacked to pieces, yet they came back again. You see, friends, Scripture calls us to deal with our sin like Samuel dealt with Agag. Hacked it to pieces. Kill it. The remaining sin, the residing sin in our unredeemed humanness, our flesh, has to be destroyed. It has to be followed up, found, and destroyed. And we want to do that. And we're never going to enjoy what Paul experienced in his bold confidence about a holy and a godly, sincere conscience unless, you know, we put sin to death. Turn over to Colossians chapter 3 for a moment. Colossians 3 verse 5. Colossians 3, verse 5. Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Things like fornication, immorality, uncleanness, passion, evil desire. Put them to death. Kill them. You can't do it partially. Can't do it half-heartedly. You can't have remaining in your life an Agag to sort of leave him there. No, you got to kill it. You got to hack it to pieces. You've got to keep, you know, a tight rein on sin in your life. Confess it, forsake it. Sins like Amalekites have a way of escaping the slaughter, breeding, reviving, and launching new and unexpected assaults on our most vulnerable areas. So just recapping on what Paul was saying to the Romans last week in Romans chapter 8, verses 12 through 13. Getting out of Romans 7, where you're wretched man because the Amalekites are just bringing you down left, right, and center. How do you get out of that? Romans 7 into Romans 8? Well, he says in verses 12 and 13, therefore, brethren, we are debtors not to the flesh, to live according to the flesh, for if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. So putting to death the deeds of the body is characteristic of somebody who is living. In other words, it's characteristic of a believer to be killing the deeds of the body, to be executing the Amalekites in his or her life, living in the power of the Spirit. So after declaring victory over sin in Romans 6, and then describing the ongoing battle with sin in chapter 7, Paul comes in chapter 8 to describe how we get the triumph. You know, how do we put to death sin in our lives? How do we hack it to death? By the Spirit, through the Spirit, applying those five principles that we looked at last week. A true believer will not act like Saul, who wanted to pamper and preserve Agag, but he will act like Samuel, who hacked him mercilessly into pieces. So you see what I'm saying? You can't tame the flesh. You can't have sin as a house pet. You can't coexist with sin. You can't say, well, there's only few sins, so we'll just sort of let them run around there a little bit. It's not harming anybody. Paul says, you go after them and you mortify them. You put them to death. The Lord Jesus spoke along the same lines, didn't he, when he said about, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out, etc. He's not talking about self-mutilation. He's just talking about mortifying the flesh, putting to death the deeds of the flesh. He says you've got to do it continually, unendingly, through all of your life, as noted by the tense of that verb, as we looked at last week in Romans. Be putting to death the deeds of the body. You're moving around, slaying those sins all the time. It's a continuous struggle, persistently putting to death the deeds of the flesh, because mortification of sin, the killing of sin, involves the cultivation of new habits, spiritual habits, godliness, eliminating all the old habits and generating good habits. On the positive side, you begin to do godly things, and the negative side, you stop doing the sinful things. And that is a constant warfare to which we must remain perpetually committed if we're going to gain the victory.